Okay, Ella, I'm gonna go ahead and read the thing. There is comfort in believing in things beyond our control, even if those things are evil. People are very good at spotting patterns and forms in disparate pieces of information and making intuitive leaps. Sometimes these leaps lead to new breakthroughs in mathematics or sciences. Sometimes they shed new light on the psychology of humanity. And sometimes they become dangerous, self-feeding messes that spread hatred, distrust, and generally keep us from having a fully functioning society because Uncle Carl won't stop screaming at us about how a secret cabal of reptilian dinosaur humanoids secretly control the weather. That's right, dear sister, on this episode of Relative Disasters, we're going to talk about conspiratorial thinking. Welcome to Relative Disasters, the show where I get to scream into the void, put that void into a podcast, and send it out to my sister and anyone else who feels like listening. We like to manage our existential dread by talking about terrible and interesting historical events, their context, implications, and any related sidebars that tend to distract me. My name is Greg, my sister's name is Ella, and Ella, I thought I'd start off our new season by tackling the topic of conspiratorial thinking, because it is definitely a massive disaster, and the science behind it is fascinating. Our main sources for this episode come from several scientific publications, including, and these are all a real mouthful, so please bear with me, From the Unbelievable to the Undeniable, Epistemological Pluralism or How Conspiracy Theorists Legitimate Their Extraordinary Truth Claims by Steph Aupers and Jaron Hammerbaum, published in the European Journal of Cultural Studies, Belief in Conspiracy Theories and Susceptibility to the Conjunction Fallacy by Christopher C. French and Robert Brotherton, published in Applied Cognitive Psychology. Belief in Conspiracy Theories, The Predictive Role of Schizotypy, Machiavellianism, and Primary Psychopathy by Evita March and Jordan Springer in the Public Library of Science in December of 2019. As well as these peer-reviewed journal publications, a number of contemporary articles from Scientific American and the New England Journal of Medicine, and a fascinating study on how the amygdala and frontal lobes process information, including Amygdala Hijack, Symptoms, Causes, and Prevention by Adam Rodin in Medical News Today, and Two Parts of the Brain Govern Much of Mental Life, Understanding the Roles of the Amygdala and the Prefrontal Cortex by Jeremy Shapiro, PhD, published in Psychology Today. So, what is a conspiracy theory? Well, it's important to distinguish from both a theory and a conspiracy. A conspiracy is a group of people working in a non-public way to accomplish a goal, usually not a great one. A theory is, in its broadest sense, an idea you have that you can then support with evidence, replicate, and eventually prove. For example, gravity is a theory. So a conspiracy theory, though, is an attempt to explain an event or a series of events as being caused or being under the control of a group that is secretive, powerful, and sinister. Said events often have a simpler and more logical explanation, but the appeal is not the information. The appeal is the emotional reaction gotten by being on the inside of the conspiratorial information, none of which can be proven, and of course none of which can be disproven to the satisfaction of the people engaging in this manner of thinking, since it's an ever-moving set of goalposts. I won't really be talking about specific conspiracy theories in this episode, because what causes people to engage in this behavior is much more interesting than the stuff they actually try to believe. There's even a conspiracy theory about the term conspiracy theory, so you can see how we'd be bailing against the tide and trying to tackle this stuff. And first of all, I want to stress at the outset that people who partake in conspiratorial thinking are not evil or stupid. We all have a very weird blind spot in how we humans process information, and the people who engage in this type of behavior are being tricked by what I'm going to call the golden triangle of horse manure. They are receiving bad information from people acting in bad faith. They're being pushed into the muck by grifters, hucksters, and con artists who do not have their best interests at heart, and their own brains are conspiring against them. When somebody tells you that a conspiracy theory is all in your head, well, it kinda is. To start off, we're going to break this down into the brain science and the psychology and sociology of the topics. To begin with, we're going to start talking about the brain, that delightful mass of weirdness between our ears that has the capability of calculating the distances between stars and the ability to disbelieve that those stars even exist. Specifically, we're going to be talking about the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex and how they are constantly playing tug of war inside your head. I am going to be simplifying a whole lot here. There's a ton of really well-written, accessible scientific papers that go into this in much more detail. But for the purposes of this, since I'm not teaching a college-level course in brain anatomy, essentially, your amygdala is responsible for your quick reactions to situations, and your prefrontal cortex is responsible for your response to that information once you've had a second to think about it. It's another oversimplification, but your amygdala is your knee-jerk emotional reaction, and your prefrontal cortex is your ability to process that reaction into a reasonable response. A person cuts you off in traffic, your amygdala is the one that slams on the brakes and keeps you safe. A tiger jumps out from behind a tree, your amygdala is what's triggering your fight-or-flight response before you've even fully processed what is happening. Your amygdala is your bodyguard. It's built to react quickly to threats and keep you alive. Your prefrontal cortex, once your initial less than a second amygdala response is over, is what processes what happened. The car that cut you off didn't see you in their blind spot, and the tiger behind the tree is still behind the fence at the zoo, so that's fine. Let's go ahead and have an embarrassed, nervous laugh about the whole thing. If your amygdala is your bodyguard, your prefrontal cortex is your scientist, processing and analyzing the information that's been presented. And that's how they're supposed to work. But we've got a really big blind spot between those two processes. So recent studies into the amygdala seem to suggest that during a person's most formative years, their brains really start wrestling over who gets the keys to the car, and the one that gets the most stimuli wins that tug of war. If you grew up in an environment where your amygdala is overstimulated by genuine danger to you, whether it's an unsafe living situation, unsafe surroundings, traumatic events, all of these things form synaptic pathways that tell the amygdala that it needs to take charge to keep you safe. If you grow up in an environment where physical danger isn't as recurring a thing, where you're allowed to process the traumas of life in a safe way, where you don't have to constantly fight to feel safe, then your prefrontal cortex has more of a chance to get better at analyzing what's going on around you and determining if something is actually a threat or just a screen door slamming in the wind. In those cases where a person's amygdala isn't overstimulated, it acts properly to keep its human safe. I want to be very clear here. This is not to state that someone who grows up in a traumatic environment is doomed to repeat that cycle. It's actually really far from that. It's just that on a neurological level, that person has to do more work to make the new synaptic pathways and get their prefrontal cortex involved. When people pay attention to their thought processes and put the work in to engage that non-reactive, able-to-process part of the brain, that's where amazing things like empathy come from. Most people who endure hardships during their formative years, in fact, are people with deep wells of empathy because they are lacking that last psychological component to turn them into our conspiratorial thinker, and that missing secret sauce is a nice heaping dose of narcissism. Now that we've established the very simplified neuroscience, we're going to dig into the psychology. At its heart, conspiratorial thinking arises when someone is presented with information and reacts to it with a reactive negative emotion, thank you a lot, amygdala, and then filters that reaction through a mesh of paranoia, psychological projection, and narcissism, because their neural pathways want that quick hit of the anger-fear reaction off the amygdala, not the analytical response from the prefrontal cortex. Basically, we want to get mad at the problem. We don't want to solve it because solving it is out of our control. It's too big. It's too many people. It's too many people who are way too powerful. So we can't do anything about it other than get angry. Paranoia is not just people are out to get me. It is a fear response to new stimuli that automatically categorizes new things into the threat column. Psychological projection has a lot to do with things that you see about yourself that you don't like, but you don't want to deal with them about yourself, so you push those onto other people. Oh, I can't stand people that wear green jackets, says the man in the green jacket. And narcissism is, I feel like that's a fairly common term, but not always well applied. Narcissism isn't just the standard thing that we think of like, oh, I'm the best at everything. Hi, everybody. So I really messed up on the recording of this part right here. So rather than re-record the whole thing, I figured I'd just drop this in and make it super awkward by explaining it as well. The point that I was trying to get to in this section is that the psychological narcissistic component revolves around believing that you know better than the experts based on your limited knowledge in their field, and believing that it is more important for you to be right than for you to be correct. In other words, you want to win the argument, you don't necessarily need to be factually accurate. And I feel like we've all felt like that at one point or another. The wanting to win more than wanting to do the right thing, for example. But in this particular case, to fit this particular criteria, what's required of the person is that they will actively discount knowledge that is counter to what they believe to be true on the basis that they must know better than the other people. Or, obviously, because we're talking conspiracy theories, that anyone who provides evidence to the contrary is simply in on the conspiracy. And we'll talk about that in a bit. So that's the very awkward drop-in. And now back to the rest of it. Okay, bye. Now, people under these responses will still use their prefrontal cortex. However, what they're using it for is to justify what they're believing after the fact. I really want to stress again that modern psychology does not view people who engage in conspiratorial thinking as pathological. Again, it's a pair of nasty blind spots in our methods of processing information. It's not a person waking up one day and choosing evil. By the time someone is actively engaging in the end products of their chosen conspiracy theory, whether by anger or violence or sheer refusal of reality, their ability to perceive the information that their brain is receiving is so damaged, they're not able to understand that they're operating under flawed premises. If I seem overly forgiving of these folks, I think it's because I completely understand how a person can get to that point. So let's talk about that second blind spot, because it's fascinating and it's horrifying. And combined with the amygdala prefrontal cortex tug of war, it is why we do these things. Human beings are really, really good at recognizing patterns. We have been doing it constantly, and we have been doing it as long as we've had sentience. Recognizing patterns keeps us alive, whether it's which berries are safe to eat, or hey, all these other cars are slowing down, so maybe I should tap on the brakes until we figure out what's going on. We are so good at recognizing patterns, in fact, we can even see them when they aren't there. All right, Ella, I have a quick statistics riddle for you. Let's say I've got a perfectly weighted coin, and if I flip that coin 100 times, it will come up heads 50 times and tails 50 times. Now, I have just flipped it 4 times, and every single one of those 4 times, it has come up heads. If you had to bet money on whether the next flip will be heads again, would you take that bet? Well, again, it depends on who's driving. Your emotional center really wants to trick you into thinking that that's a pattern. It's been heads 4 times. We've got a really good chance at having it be heads the next time, right? Or it'll enact what's also called the gambler's fallacy, which is, whoa, 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 it's been heads the last 4 times, therefore we are due a tails, so it's got to be tails. Your prefrontal cortex, meanwhile, is shaking its head and sort of gently tapping your amygdala on the shoulder and saying, buddy, it really is just a 50-50 chance every time. And depending on who you listen to tells you a lot about how you process that information. There is a psychological concept called apophenia, which is what it's called when our brains finds one of these patterns that aren't really there. And usually, it's completely harmless. We've all looked up at the clouds and seen defined shapes, right? You look up at the cloud and you're, oh, it's a kitty. Now, your brain knows that cats are generally not huge, floating, white, fluffy things in the sky. That's a subset of apophenia called pareidolia, where people perceive images or sounds in random things like a face in a plank of wood or hearing a word in radio static. Most of the time, they hit our amygdala and then trigger our prefrontal cortex, which is why you're sitting there saying, that cloud looks like a cat, instead of, oh no, cats are now gigantic and capable of flight. Apophenia's main weapon when it comes to conspiratorial thinking is the logical fallacy of correlation equaling causation. This thing must be the result of this other thing happening. So, the number of hurricanes has risen every year, while the number of pirates in the Caribbean Sea has declined. Therefore, in order to combat hurricanes, we need to reintroduce pirates to the Caribbean. One has nothing to do with the other, but my brain thought it saw a pattern. Now, if I published a scientific paper on this subject, the decline of government-funded privateers in the Caribbean Sea and its direct effects on El Niño, that paper would probably encounter some fairly stiff resistance from the scientific community and those peer-reviewing it. For starters, my sample size is likely small and out of date. My data is almost certainly cherry-picked and incomplete. There may be a few leaps of logic that require further research and justification, because the burden of proof is on me. It is not up to the general scientific community to disprove my theory. It is up to me to present evidence supporting my theory. So basically, I'm not going to win my Nobel for this. I guess that's what I'm saying. Now, nearly every conspiracy theory has that criteria. Bad science, an appeal to emotion instead of fact, unverifiable or bad sources, and an underlying tone of cynicism, fear, and hatred, all boiling together to get you to stop thinking and start believing. A lot of people, researchers included, used to operate under the assumption that a conspiracy theory would start small to rope in its victims. You know, here's a little piece of a conspiracy, and then once you believe that, we'll get you to do a bigger piece. But analysis of these patterns actually shows that it is the exact opposite. If you really want to shut off somebody's ability to think analytically, start big, start huge, and start hateful. A conspiracy theory is not a scalpel. It's a bludgeon, and it's a balm in one blow. There are people who want to harm you, but only you and I know the truth. Now, everybody's had something that's gone wrong in their life. And since everybody's had something that's gone wrong in their life, give them somebody to blame for it. The things about your life that are bad, they are not your fault. It's their fault. That is dangerously seductive, and it leads to something that, again, I really want to stress. There is no such thing as a harmless conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories actually share some very startling and scary similarities with cults. They believe in isolation. It's us against them, and them, in this case, is anybody who doesn't believe us. They attack the language centers of their members by redefining or inventing terms. Cults use this to further isolate their members, and conspiracy theory people develop their own jargon and signals to other members of the group. And they feed a constant sense of fear and danger. They are always out to get you, and we are the only things that are righteous and can keep you safe. And invariably, it leads to a worsening of society. It stokes fear and anger. If you dig deep enough into any conspiracy theory, you will find the absolute ugliest things of humanity: fear and the prejudice that comes from it. Again, all done by people who are firmly certain that what they are doing is the right thing. These have real consequences, from domestic terrorism, to families being torn apart, to teachers teaching pseudo-history in their classrooms, to the general level of distrust in modern science and medicine. The intent of a conspiracy theory at its root is to do harm and to create a firm line between believers and non-believers, and to enforce that line with violence if need be. The steps that it takes to get from shock to belief to violence are upsettingly short. And here's the thing. I get it, guys. I really do. The world can be a scary place where bad things happen. And wouldn't it be, for lack of a better term, kind of nice to have an answer for that? Lizard people secretly rule the world. Fluoride is in your drinking water so that the government can mind control you. Global warming isn't really happening. The moon is hollow. The earth is hollow. I heard it from a friend of a friend of mine who totally saw it, and it all makes sense. This is the piece of information you've been missing. Why do bad things happen? Lizard people. Why do they happen to you? Because you've run afoul of the Illuminati. Why aren't things in my life working out the way I want them to? Jewish space lasers, obviously. Because it's easier. It's so much easier to blame this othered them conspiracy. The conspiracy gives you something to fight. You're armed with secret knowledge that only you and a privileged few know, and it sets your sights on the enemy. And anyone who disproves it is just part of the conspiracy, or they're too stupid to understand the truth. Not like you. And now you are distrusting yourself, your eyes, your brain, your sense of self. You have to give yourself over to this theory completely and never question it. Because once those cracks begin to show, the whole thing comes tumbling down. Human beings respond much more easily to anger than most other emotions. Have you noticed how many online publications have had to embrace the so-called hate click algorithm, which is driving views to their sites by hiring freelance writers to obnoxiously attack something that a majority of people like? You've seen the headlines that are written intentionally to make your blood boil, and boom, you're engaged. It's the same basic principle with conspiracy theories. Does the idea of children being sold into slavery anger you? Yes, good. It should. Child slavery is real, and it needs to be stamped out with as much righteous fury as we can muster. And did you hear of this group that's taking children as slaves and then cannibalizing them? Well, that's positively inhuman. Those people should be dragged out in the street and shot. Well, good. Those people are your political leaders. Well, I always knew I couldn't trust them. And there you go. From one thing that is real, provable, and horrific, child slavery, to something that is not real, with no actual evidence, and even more horrific, that's the big lie that shocks your brain, and you're involved in this conspiracy theory. So what do you do? Well, you don't want to be sucked in, you don't want to be fooled, but there's so much evidence to support this theory, so it must be true. Our critical thinking skills, as we've demonstrated, are pretty easy to short-circuit, and I will give you an example. The number of children with red eyes has been on the rise since 1990. Now, we've been teaching math with green textbooks since 1988. Coincidence? Well, if you look further, you'll see that the green dye on these math books contains chontriticosiluene, a compound that's found in greater amounts in these red-eyed children. We need to ban green textbooks immediately, and anyone who says we shouldn't hates children. Well, that was easy. So, how did you fall for that? You didn't, right? You followed the evidence I laid out to its conclusion, and it convinced you. You didn't fall for anything, and now you know something. You have secret knowledge, and you need to fight to protect everyone's children. Well, there is one thing. First of all, children with red eyes have not been rising over the last few decades because it's not a thing. Second, correlation is not causation. Two things happening at similar times or places may be linked, but often they're not, but our brains really, really want them to be. We are wired to recognize patterns even where patterns don't exist, and while that may have served us well while eating berries on the savannah somewhere, that's the part of our brains that gets tricked. And third, I may have an agenda. After you read my article, look me up, research me. Do I work for the red textbook company? Well, then maybe don't take my word for it that green textbooks are hurting children. And fourth, and this is the one that most theories would prefer you skip, think critically about what I'm saying. Am I offering proof or am I offering conjecture? Proof should be repeatable. If I drop a tennis ball 1,000 times, it will fall downwards, not float upwards maybe once or twice. That's a pretty good way to see for myself that gravity exists. But you can't go out and inject green textbook dye into yourself and see if you get red eyes. That's not how any of this works, by the way. So you can't repeat the circumstances that I've described. Could you look up chontriticosiluene? Sure, but it's a complex chemical compound, and the majority of us aren't chemical engineers. So what can we do? We can check around and see what the researchers who are experts are finding. If you see a paper that supports the chontriticosiluene theory and 90 other papers stating that it's nonsense and providing support for their theses, Well, it's probably nonsense. And finally, check your emotional response. Does my theory make you angry? Does it make you feel attacked? Or does it make you feel like I just confirmed something that you felt like you already knew? Well, good, because it's designed to do that. It's designed to make you feel, not think. It's designed to give you the feeling of, I knew it! And the part of us in that amygdala that kind of likes being manipulated and tricked. And now I've got you believing in my green textbook hardened children theory, which you can share with all your friends on social media and find more people who believe the same thing. Even though it's total nonsense, and your prefrontal cortex knows it's total nonsense. Your rational brain is really good at figuring out when you're being lied to. It's not really good at telling your amygdala to shut up and get out of the way. The real conspiracies always fall apart. Always. Let's take an easy one. We never landed on the moon. The whole thing was shot on a soundstage by Stanley Kubrick so we could win a victory in the Cold War. Okay. Let's take it piece by piece. We're not going to go through every piece of so-called evidence for this theory because, again, I'm not playing whack-a-mole here. I'm just taking the broader view. To start with, everyone at NASA is a liar and in on the conspiracy. Nobody who works there or has ever worked there chose to expose it for fame or fortune or because it would be the right thing to do. Nobody wanted their Nobel. No paperwork was ever kept and no mistakes were ever made. The so-called astronauts took that secret to their grave. Everyone on the film crew, from Stanley Kubrick to the key grip, kept their mouth shut. Thousands and thousands of people knew about this firsthand, and not one of them spilled the beans ever at any time in their lives. I don't know about you, but I find that a lot harder to believe than a bunch of really dedicated scientists took a bunch of really dedicated science and landed on the moon. The Tuskegee experiments, one of the most horrific medical abuses of all time, lasted until somebody leaked that information and laid the whole thing bare before the American people. And that was something that only a handful of doctors and administrators were involved. Watergate took 2 years. Somebody always talks. Sometimes the event is too horrific for us, so we choose to believe something easier. Which is easier, believing that a mentally unstable man walked into a grade school with military-grade weapons and murdered a number of children, or that the whole thing was faked by actors to try to pass a restrictive gun law? Well, I don't want to believe that someone would do that. And if I'm someone who feels particularly possessive of my guns, I don't want somebody taking them away because a tragedy happened to someone else. So it must be fake. Please tell me it's fake. Because I don't want to know the pain that those parents feel is real. It's got to be fake. Conspiracy theories make me sad. I don't like to think of myself as stupid or easily fooled, and I don't like to think of other people that way. But when a major event happens, especially a tragedy, somebody always pops up and says, "Don't believe your eyes and ears, and don't believe the experts who've been studying this. I know the truth." And if you buy my book, listen to my podcast, subscribe and follow and like, you will too. And that's the real conspiracy, preying on people who just want to make the world make sense. But it doesn't. Sometimes there are motivations we can attach to events, meanings we can take from things that happen. And sometimes things just happen. So what can we do? It's pretty common knowledge that more information isn't the solution because conspiracy theories, by definition, are insular and self-fulfilling. Any information that contradicts the premise of the conspiracy theory is actually just proof that whoever provides that information is in on it. A conspiracy theory cannot be disproven, okay? Because it's a matter of faith, not a matter of information. And while I applaud everyone who engages in a good faith educational effort toward conspiratorial thinkers, it's usually fairly futile unless part of a dedicated strategy, because there is a way to fix this, and it's pretty simple. Confrontation and information that disproves the conspiracy theory only serves to further entrench that person. Instead, you need to keep your own amygdala in check and your own prefrontal cortex active and respond, as hard as it is, with empathy. Acknowledge how the person is feeling. Wow, that sounds scary. You sound really worried about that. Can I get you some tea? and then start gently working your way through the logical fallacies. Hey, the source that you're citing here doesn't make sense to me. Can you explain it to me? Expect scientific concepts to be cited, but expect them to be misunderstood or misapplied. Then begin to offer up supported evidence from verifiable sources, and expect a wide range of emotions: anger, embarrassment, shame, and always give this person a way to save face. Don't box them in, give them an out. Approach with empathy. Engage with empathy that's supported by facts. Ask them to clarify it for you so they can figure out for themselves that they don't actually have as good a grasp on this as they thought. Challenge their informational sets in as friendly a way as possible. This approach is gentle, but know that the stakes are high. Conspiratorial-based violence is really high right now all over the world. And the truth of our very existence is under more of a threat than I think I've ever seen in my lifetime. So be the person who's safe. Be the person who checks their sources when they learn of something new. It is a great thing to pull out your phone and say, "Oh my gosh, I hadn't heard that," and look it up yourself. Many people who've been sucked into conspiratorial thinking are looking for understanding. They're looking for a community. They're looking for a reason behind what's gone wrong in their own lives. Self-awareness is not a super valued trait in these communities. And the more you can do to encourage that, the better. Embrace pluralism. Encourage empathy. Don't assume you know everything. Look it up by experts in the field, not by some dude. And keep track of whether your prefrontal cortex or your amygdala is in the driver's seat. The government is a really good boogeyman, but we need to all remember that it's just people. Some elected, some appointed, some who just work there, all of whom are just people. Some of these people do act against the best interests of the people they claim to represent, but most are just trying to do a job. File some papers, try to figure out why the printer's not working today. I'm reminded of a sociology professor who told me once, never attribute to malice what can be first attributed to incompetence. People will make mistakes. People will brag and feel proud when they do something they think will win them support. So, for example, if somebody makes a statement about how malicious they will be if elected, believe them. But most of the time, it's just people being people. As David Bowie once said so beautifully, we're just taller children. I've avoided specific conspiracy theories as much as possible in this episode because I know by the time I'm done speaking, 18 more will have popped into life fully formed, and trying to play whack-a-mole with everything that comes up is futile. Blanket statement. The burden of proof is on the person making the claim, and innuendo and rumor are not fact. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. We can all do better with our information literacy and analytical thinking. And the fact that we do live in an open society wherein information, factual, sourced, peer-reviewed information, is readily available is a really good thing. One of the reasons we cite our sources on this show is because we want to be transparent with where our information comes from. I heard from a friend of a friend's cousin who works with a pilot that once flew on a plane with a neighbor of a NASA astronaut. That's not a source. That's a story. Come back when you've looked into it a bit more. And please, when doing your own research, understand that if your sources are buried in the 12th page of results, are not peer-reviewed, are written by people who are not experts in their field, and are written by people trying to sell you something, that's not doing your own research. That's digging until you find something you think supports your opinion. Another logical fallacy of which we should all be careful. Especially if the source is a very charismatic con man who wants to sell you something. We are amazing creatures, capable of great works and terrible violence, beautiful art, and the spiteful hatred of things we don't understand. We should be better. We are far too cool of a life form to waste the time that we have to experience this universe on believing in nonsense that encourages separation and hate, when all we really want to do is hang out, make friends, and discover cool stuff. The world is exactly as violent, dangerous, and evil as we choose to make it. And much, much, much more importantly, the reverse is true. And that's what gives me hope. Here at Relative Disasters, we do make sure to fact-check our work to bring you the most accurate disasters experience possible. If you'd like to know more about our sources, they're cited at the beginning of the episode. Sometimes we do make mistakes, of course, so I have a little bit of housekeeping here. In our episode on Oliver Sipple, I had thought that his middle name was William. I want to thank alert listener Elizabeth for letting me know that it was, in fact, Wellington, which is an objectively much cooler middle name. I also want to thank Julie for writing in and sharing about your dad. Ella and I hope he recovers well, and I'm glad that our nerdy little podcast is something for the two of you to share and enjoy. It has been pointed out to me as well that we are missing two episodes. Yeah, that is true. Our Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald episode has been accidentally deleted. I'm working on getting it back up as soon as I can get the original source back. Also, we are missing one of our extended sidebars. It was on this phenomenon called the Mellified Man, in which a dying person's body would be thoroughly infused with honey. It was really gross. Ella felt really weird about having it up there, so we took it down. And as always, if you have any thoughts to share or corrections we need to know, as long as they're not about conspiracy theories, please write to us at relative.disasters@gmail.com. We cannot respond to our emails, but we do read each and every one. Or if you'd like to shame us publicly, and we know you do, why not try our Instagram at relative.disasters. A big thank you to our patrons who support us at Relative Disasters Podcast on Patreon. A number of folks have decided to move on from us with Ella's departure, and I'd like to thank them for sticking with us as long as they did. I know it's not an easy thing to give away your money to a pair of doofuses like us, and we both really appreciate all of our patrons, past and present. You guys are great and help us justify keeping this podcast ad-free. This week's podcast was brought to you by Katie, who has actually landed on the moon and states that it was, quote, neat, end quote, and Julie, who is just really tired of her local otter population conspiring against her. Thank you all so much for joining us for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed the story, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Ella, it's about time we tackled another massive plague of insects. So next week, we're going to take a look at one of the strangest insect infestations of all time. On the next episode of Relative Disasters, the 1976 Ladybird Plague. Have a good week, and I'll see you then.